listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
In the interior circuit, Francisco Goldman drags us into his Mexico City, the place that for over 20 years he's been visiting and living as an on-again, off-again resident, a place for him where love affairs and novels are born, a place where he, quote, fell in love with the girl next door, that girl being, as it's known to locals, El DF, El Distrito Federal. In a quest to unleash the grip that grief has held on Goldman's life since the untimely passing of his wife, Aura Estrada, almost 7 years ago next week, he seeks to take hold of life, literally and figuratively, by grabbing the steering wheel and navigating himself through El DF, on a challenge to learn how to drive in that city of millions, where people can literally be sucked into a dark abyss on a daily basis. Frank actually shares a story about un señor Gutierrez literally being sucked into a sewer drain during a flash flood a few summers ago, and where the backdrop of a years-long drug war had, until recently, been contained to the area outside of the city. It was only so long that DF would stay insulated from it, and as part of his journey, Goldman also navigates through the narco war as an investigative journalist in the inexplicable case of the Heavens kidnapping, probing for answers that extend far beyond his own. Goldman's chronicle reveals how the personal and the political are inextricably linked, and his raw, vulnerable writing brings us into intimate contact with his journey and that of the girl next door, implicitly leaving one to examine how the FA is woven into our own interior circuit, both personal and political. Francisco Goldman is the author of 5 other books, including the penultimate Say Her Name, the intimate and raw memoir reportage chronicle of love and loss. He is the founder of the Premio Aura Estrada, a prize for young writers of fiction, and he splits his time between Mexico City and the East Coast, where he teaches one semester a year at Trinity College. Joining Goldman tonight in conversation is another writer who straddles borders, our own Ruben Martinez, frequent guest on the Aloud stage. Martinez, chair of literature and writing at Loyola Marymount University, is also the author of many books, and most recently, Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. He is the curator of a series titled The War on Both Sides, an examination of the role of the creative community in a drug war reaping horrific tolls on both sides of the border. And I encourage you to read his most recent essay, a beautiful piece, in the LA Review of Books on Goldman's interior circuit. So without further ado, please help me welcome our authors to the Aloud stage, Francisco Goldman and Ruben Martinez.
Frank.
Thank you.
Welcome, Frank, to Los Angeles.
Thank you, Ruben.
Via DF and Brooklyn. Welcome you all. Thank you, Maureen, for your gracious introduction, to Louise Steinman, to Sarah Charlton, and the Aloud crew and the Library Foundation here for bringing us together tonight. I'm curious to know, before we begin our conversation with Frank, just who you are. And why you're here. There's some diehard fans of Frank's wonderful literary oeuvre, of course. But Mexico City, I want to know how many people have visited Mexico City. Please raise your hands. That's just about everybody in the crowd.
Everybody.
I want to know, though, how many bona fide Chilangos, Mexico City natives, are in the crowd tonight.
Not natives.
Not that many. But some. Okay, and how many Mexicans who are not from Mexico City raise your hands? Now, those people who just raised their hands, how many of you, be honest, how many of you hate Mexico City Chilangos?
No.
Yes, they're insufferable.
No,
arrogant.
That's not true.
metropolitan, elitists. And those of us from Los Angeles, just provincials, to the anyway. We are here to speak about a tremendous work, literary work, a work of journalism and memoir, kind of all rolled into one. And I do want to start by saying that here in Los Angeles, I think a lot of us feel quite a close relationship with Mexico City, right. And it runs quite deep. The Million Dollar Theater right down the street from us hosted acts from Mexico City going way back to the heyday of Mexican pop acts, Miguel Aceves Mejia and so many others, Lola Beltran. The Siqueiros was here, straight out of Mexico City, came out here and did a mural downtown on Olivera Street. Ricardo Flores Magón was in Mexico City, came up here and started anarchist agitation back in the day.
Did he really?
Wow. And of course, Mexico City.
Oh, he is.
Mexico City is Mexico's Hollywood.
Yeah.
And there was all kinds of co-productions between Mexico City and so there's a relationship, and all of you have.
Well, early in the book, I live in the Casa Fuerte del Indio Fernández, right?
That's right.
I recount one of the first homes I had in Mexico.
Mexico's
City.
Great director, actor,
golden age director, and he literally the Oscar statue is based on his body. I forget the connection, but I knew it at one point, but it's true. And whoever had the job of sculpting that statue, he posed. Yeah.
Yes. Erguido.
Yeah.
Esa posa, no? Right?
Yeah. No, that was in 1993. I lived there. And that was really...
Well, so among the Chicanos, Chicanos, us, in the crowd,
yeah.
At sign, right? Chicanos, us. Many of us went to Mexico City to find our roots, to go climb the Pyramid of the Sun, to go to see where the Virgin appeared to Juan Diego, el Cerro de Tepeyac. What drew you first to Mexico City?
I had to get paid. I was working as a freelance journalist in Central America in the 80s. I was like a kid, I was at that age where you can live on 2 freelance articles a year. I think I'm 1984, 85, around then. I think it was right before the earthquake. And I was working as a freelance journalist. I was living in what had been in Guatemala City, my grandmother's house. She had died. My cousin and his wife lived downstairs, and I had a spinster aunt, Tia Nano, who lived upstairs, and that was where I was living. So I didn't have to pay rent, and I was very lucky that I was, I say Harper's Magazine's correspondent. That sounds very grand. I'd get to do 2 or 3 pieces a year, and that's what I would live on, and maybe pick up a freelance piece here and there. And it was great because... I had my house, little house in Guatemala City. So if I had to do a piece in Managua or Salvador or Honduras, I'd go stay at other young freelancers' houses. It was like pre-Airbnb. And then when they came to Guatemala City to do a story, they could stay in my house. No? That's how it worked. But Harper's Magazine, there was no way for them to wire me my pay in Guatemala City. Those bank arrangements didn't exist. And so I had to come up to Mexico City, I was told, to get my pay. And I'd never been there before. And it was a really incredible journey. I'll never forget it as long as I live. The AP, it was incredible. We were, nobody who's an established correspondent or journalist in the world wanted to go to Central America. Right? If you were stationed in Paris or even the Middle East and they said, things are getting hot in Central America, we want to transfer you there, they'd go, no way am I going there. So it just opened up all these opportunities for young freelancers. So it's just incredible what a roster it is. When I look at the young 23, 24, 25-year-old reporters that were crawling around Central America in the early 80s, and now it's like an all-star team of reporters. you know, including my best friend from that era, John Lee Anderson. But the first time I came up to Mexico, it was with, he was then just an AP stringer. Now he's the big star reporter at NPR, John Burnett. And it was a terrifying time. It was probably the most, a short period, which was probably the bloodiest and most terrifying in the history of Guatemala City, the early 80s, when they were really cracking down on the urban network. It just completely decimated, not just the urban guerrilla networks, but used that as a pretext to wipe out union leaders, student groups, you know, center-left politicians, even center-right politicians. It was completely insane. And we were at a party one night, and a Peace Corps guy left the party. And he'd gone about a few blocks from the party. He was intercepted and murdered. And the rumor ran around, because he was a tall, pale Texan with glasses, that the assassins had mistaken him for John Burnett. It turned out not to be the case, but he was terrified, you know. So we were just dying to get out of Guatemala City and get a break. And I said, well, I have to get my pay. I don't have any money. I have to get my pay in Mexico City. And we did this drive up. It was the most extraordinary drive. I'll just never forget the release of crossing the border, right, and standing on the Mexican side and that river, you know? I remember we were crazy. We just yelled curses back across the river at the Guatemalan soldiers manning the border post on the other side, you know? And got in the car and drove to Mexico City. And I got here, and I got to Mexico City, and I didn't have a penny. I was flat broke. And it was Christmas. And so I was told the banks weren't going to be open for another 9 days. Like, everything was going to shut down. And I had to turn my passport in. I stayed in a little hotel downtown. I think a little hotel that was later by the earthquake, like 6 months later, turned to rubble. And I had to hand in my passport. And luckily, I knew journalists, so they would lend me money. And I'd walk to the Alameda every day and eat tacos. And because it was the Christmas season, there were lots of parties journalists were getting invited to. So people would tell me, I remember going to this incredible party at the Soviet embassy. It's, and it was so clear what was going on, because a Soviet journalist could not circulate through Central America. They could go to Nicaragua, that was it. A Soviet journalist setting foot in Guatemala or Salvador was going to be killed, right? So they were really, the whole idea was to get all these journalists who'd worked in Central America and get them as drunk as they could get you and try to get information out of you. So I'll never forget, that party was great. And, it was so romantic. I remember I saw my first on that same trip, the Reuters correspondent, Mark Fazlola, who's now a main guy at the Philadelphia Inquirer, he was also just a stringer, took me up into the Reuters building. And this was the equivalent of the first page of 100 Years of Solitude when, you know, Aureliano Buendía gets taken to see ICE. I saw my first fax machine. I was like, what is that? And the best moment, my favorite memory, is John and I went to the Museo Rufino Tamayo. I still, to this day, can't believe this happened. There was just this really beautiful girl there. And it turned out she was an art student. She was from the Yucatan. Her name was Selena. We started talking in the museum. And we got outside on the front steps of the museum. We started making out. It was like my second day in Mexico City. And I just couldn't believe it. And that kind of stuff never happens to me. And the next day, she was going to the Yucatan for Christmas, for the whole Christmas vacation with her family, because that's where they were from. And I never saw her again. But so I fell in love with Mexico City right then and
we
there.
We hear this. Yeah. We hear you. as have many before and many will come after. The since, and now writing this book on the city, the bohemian generations that were there before you, the literary expatriates or people just passing through. D.H. Lawrence was there in the 20s. Breton was there in the 30s or 40s. The Beats were there in the 50s. Bolaño was there in the early 70s, right? Yeah. When you sit down and you say, I'm going to write Mexico City, how much was that big literary aura about the city was on your mind? I'm now becoming part of the cadre, you know.
I never thought of that ever, even slightly. Mm-hmm. I had an intimate connection to that golden age generation of expats. I just can't help mentioning now that you mentioned Breton and stuff. Mm-hmm. To go back to, and the first time I lived in Mexico City for any period of time, it was because we lived in New York, and we said, my first novel was about to come out. I think I still had a little bit of work to do on it, Long Night of White Chickens, which is all about my time in Central America. I had a girlfriend, Tina, who was half Cuban, and she went down to Mexico City to find a place for us to live. And she found the Casa Fuerte del Indio Fernandez, the great movie director, had totally fallen into decadence. It was complete rubble. And his alcoholic only daughter was renting out rooms. And she saw an ad and she went to get a room there. And she fell in love with the place because you had to ring these. It was in Coyoacán, right? He'd carved this incredible castle out of several blocks in Coyoacán. He had to have an access road. He had to open up a street, which he named Dulce Olivia, because he had some love affair or something with Olivia de Havilland, or was in love with her. And this is just an amazing moment. This connects to the expats. His daughter, she fell in love with the place because when she was there, these big castle-like doors open, and a dead horse is being wheeled out in a wheelbarrow. And it just, the Mexico City romance lightning hit her at that moment. And I came back down very skeptically a few weeks later to see where we were going to live. And she shows us to this room, this tiny little room off the main courtyard, which on the wall had these murals of naked women bullfighting. And they had been done by Vargas, the guy who did the Vargas Girls in Esquire magazine. He'd been a good friend of El Indio. So El Indio had asked him to decorate the guest room.
Of course.
Right? He used to do the Esquire naked woman that were like the cheesy thing before Playboy foldouts. His daughter comes in, and I don't know why I'm slipping on her name right now. And she, the mattress was repulsive. It was disgusting. So I said, it's an old horsehair mattress. I said, we're going to have to get rid of this mattress. And she goes, you will not get rid of that mattress. She says, you don't know the great men who've left their semen in that mattress. And she described, it was the guest house. And she describes being a little girl. It overlooked this fountain. It had like these big French windows with a stone ledge. And she used to hide out there as a little girl on the ledge, she claimed, and had watched Anthony Quinn, Andre Breton, all that golden age of expat guys who had stayed there, you know, with their lovers on that mattress.
History. So this is your origin story, right?
That's my origin story.
Yeah, your origin story, and it's got hints of, all the things that we've come, that have built up this huge, you know, kind of like a castle of imaginary of Mexico City, right? Yeah. The romance of it, the exotic, and I'll use the problematic term exotic, right, aspect of it. But you've lived there now a long time, and this book is an examination of a moment where you are at a crossroads in your process of grief and mourning about Aura. It's you are on the eve of the 5th anniversary of losing her.
When it starts, yeah.
And that's a really big symbolic marker for you, because at 5 years, you will have known her more in memory than actually having been with her.
I always dreaded that date.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you approach the city at that moment. Paradoxically, that moment opens up a door to a new relationship with the city. And as Maureen mentioned, the relationship is going to be consummate, driving.
Yeah, which I didn't realize was going to be a book. Mm-hmm. You know, it was... I think one thing that, you know, this book was such a surprise to me. It was never intended to be a book. I had spoken casually with an editor at The New Yorker who really wanted me to try to do a piece on my so-called driving project, which you can get to a minute, where I was going to drive in Mexico City and had invented this kind of Ulipo game to both honor Aura and to enter into the city. And I'll come back to that in a second. But it was a really I guess that's where the book was born. It was like 5 years after Aura's death, and I literally felt that grief was really imprisoning me. You know, it had been 5 years, and I just couldn't get out of it. I felt like, how long is this going to last? I felt, you know, age closing in on me. I was like, you know, are you going to just grieve the rest of your life? Are you ever going to embrace life again? I couldn't, as much as I wanted to will myself out of that, I couldn't get out of it. And I really missed her, you know? And I couldn't find a way to live another way. And I really felt I was dragging a weight. And I was beginning to rebel against it, viscerally rebel against it too, right? In a very self-destructive way, which is how that summer began. It's a lot of, you know, I mean, I don't know, you know, it's a, if you're a writer, you stay home a lot. You know, I was working on a novel as best as I could. You know, when nighttime comes, you don't, I live in an apartment, there's no TV, there's nothing, you know, you're going to go out at night, right? And part of my circumstances, I've always been, outside of the years I was married, I've always run with a pretty wild crowd in Mexico City, as you know. No? And you know what those crowds are like. And
I have no idea what you're talking about, Frank.
And and I'd inherited also, you know, the friend, Aura was a lot younger than me, 20 years younger than me. And a lot of all the people that had been our mutual friends, kids her age, people in between us in age, they hadn't stopped being my friends. They were still my close, close friends. So I was, that summer was really crazy. No, and it turned out to be an extraordinarily important summer in my life, because in the parlance of my friends, and it's the summer I hit bottom, you know, in my search for the bottom, I found it in a very crazy, ridiculous, humiliating, absurd, violent incident that's in the book. As often happens when you touch fondo, it initiated a reawakening, right? It initiated like, okay, let's stop. Let's get control of life. No, it's, but at the same time, you know, I became aware too, you know, of how much my relationship to the city really mattered. I came out of that touching fondo because of my friends, right? It's because of, I realized how much my Mexico City friends had meant to me all those years. I realized that a decisive crossroads in my life had been, you know, Mexico City is where Aura died. This is where we fell in love, really, started to fall in love. This is where we spent a lot of our best time together. She was from Mexico City. She was as Chilanga can be. And I said, you have a choice, right? You have to sometimes I would say, I really want to flee Mexico City. That's the smartest thing to do. This place is too full of memories. I should just go live somewhere else and start over. No, and especially with like even my last book, which kind of made me into a sort of public mourner in some ways. No, it's like, and then I realized, but then there's another option. Right? Because I realized I can't go away. I can't run away. This place is like sacred ground to me. You know, and I really understood, for instance, when you read people like, you know, the theorists of nationalism and where does the sense of belonging to a place come from? And he says, you know, when you talk about, look at the colonists and so forth of the New World, right? They really begin to say, this is my country, when they begin to bury their family members there. No, and something very much like that had happened to me. And I said, so the answer is to go further in, not to flee, right? To really just embrace it. This is my home. And at the same time, so in that whole process in the summer, when I'm in my interior circuit, right, I finally sort of, you'll see in the book, if you read the book, but we'll talk about it, you know, I finally, because of this cathartic moment I have, this breakthrough I finally have, I fall in love again, I find a new girlfriend. And at the same time, the city is changing. It's a remarkable summer in the history of Mexico, in the history of Mexico City.
And it's an election year.
It's a critical election year. Mexico had
2012.
Mexico had a great opportunity. You know, Mexico did what the Soviet, the Russians did when they overthrew the communists. They did what the Chileans did when they got rid of Pinochet. Mexico got rid of the PRI in 2000. This government that had basically, when you talk about, when Vargas Llosa called it the perfect dictatorship, he meant a lot of different things. But it was a form of governing that perfected itself over 70 years. And that essentially, I mean, this is a bit reductive, but to just boil it down, it made governing and organized crime basically indistinguishable from each other. It was governing as a form of organized crime. And the country miraculously threw them off. Yay, year 2000, right? And 2012, as you all know, they come back, right? Everyone else managed to shut the door and bar them out. Mexico let them back in. And there was an extraordinary, because you have to understand, Mexico City is not like, in many ways, politically, it's not like the rest of Mexico, right? It's governed in a really different way. It's and has been governed by in a really different way since 1997. And it was just fascinating to me because the city exploded. And months before the election, there hadn't been a big student movement in Mexico City since 1968, which, of course, the year the student movement is crushed by the famous Tlatelolco massacres and horrible pre-repression, the repression that is in the very genes, DNA of the PRI, to crush dissent. And
to deny that anything ever happened.
And this just extraordinary student movement exploded. Mexico hadn't seen anything like that in 40 years. And so much came together for me there. Right? And you said, someone said something about the personal and the political. I mean, this sure is it. Outer circuit, interior circuit. Because I'm beginning to wake up. I'm going to say, if I live in this city, if I'm going to claim this is my city, I just can't be in this sort of like bubble I live in. You know, it's time to take some responsibility for what it means to live here, one. Two, it's like, you know, Aura was, you can't be more UNAM than Aura was, the university, the public university. You know, her mother was an administrator there. Her uncles were teachers there. She went to undergrad there. She did her master's degree there. You know, I mean, that was her, you know, that was her. She was so UNAM. And of course, UNAM, among other, along with, of course, the Ibero, you know, big part of the student movement. And I was just completely always wondering, well, how would she have felt about the student movement? You know, she was still would have been. All her friends were marching. And also, I'm starting to come out of things, and frankly, as you see in the book in a very subtle way, because it's one of the many humiliations I undergo, I was sort of chasing a girl,
right, who was very involved in the student movement, and it led nowhere. And so this sort of dance started to happen between my own private process in the summer of 2012 and myself beginning to immerse myself and become really interested in and really digging into what is going on publicly in Mexico. And that's the tension in the book. And the book was written, in a sense, almost as they were happening. You know, it's like it's not something I decided to do beforehand. It almost like the living and the writing were very close together.
And the self embedded in history in the moment, and you're writing it as it's happening. And I wanted to ask you just a little bit about genre. The subtitle of the book is A Mexico City Chronicle. And the American understanding of genre, the term chronicle sounds kind of old-fashioned, really. You know, the Mark Twain chronicles, you know. Yeah. It's a 19th century kind of thing. In Latin American Spanish, we use the term crónica, which is a colonial era designation. Yeah. The first cronistas were writing dispatches essentially back to the Spanish crown.
Discovery.
Right, exactly.
A journey and discovery.
Yeah. What there was of value, what they found or didn't find. But it became a mestizo thing over time, right? Yeah. And so you're invoking chronicle, and I wanted to ask you a little bit.
And now it's very much in vogue right now to write crónicas in all Latin America.
To talk about what some people have called the new, la nueva crónica latinoamericana, and how that compares to our understanding in the United States, in American literature, like the term MFA people use is creative nonfiction. I mean, there's no really good term like crónica, except chronicle, which we don't understand really. But yeah. Talk a little bit about the nueva crónica latinoamericana.
Well, I mean, in the sense that, you know, it's just that it's just creative, what we call creative nonfiction. That's all it is.
It's a terrible term.
Yeah,
can somebody come up with a better term, please?
No, and they don't get so hung up on genre. No, it's just, I think that because reality is so pressing in Latin America, reality erupts in your life in the most, often the most brutal ways. I think because so many writers don't have the luxury, you know, their conscience won't let them just simply, you know, live an ivory tower bubble existence. Right, there's just a lot of creative energy, sometimes a lot of this are people who also practice the novel, right? Just this desire, you just can't turn away from real life. There's a real impulse all over the place to write narrative about real life and not call it anything else. And crónica is just the term that people use for that kind of writing, right? And I think there's a lot of, as a genre, it has a lot of history. It becomes, back in the time of Gutierrez Nájera and José Martí and so forth, it becomes really the birthplace of modernist writing in Spanish, the crónica. Mm-hmm. So the crónica is incredibly important in Spanish.
But so a colonial artifact being repurposed.
Repurposed,
right?
And it becomes the art form of modernity because... I mean, but I'm not thinking about this when I'm writing this, but just as a digression, you know, when the telegraph cables got laid down into the ocean and across the continents, and all of a sudden in the late 19th century, when all of a sudden Latin America gets connected, right? Whereas before, news from Mexico might take 3 weeks to reach Chile. Right, with the birth of the modern newspaper and the telegraph cables, it was as big a revolution as the internet. And newspapers became the most exciting art form Latin America had ever seen. No, and the crónica, which those newspapers were the staging ground for, Rubén Darío, the great poets, all the great poets wrote crónicas. José Martí, others revolutionized the Spanish language. It's the birth of modernism. It's indistinguishable from the rise of the great Latin American poetry. It's really born in newspaper prose. But people thought like the newspaper is this great space for creative writing, but you know, creative nonfiction.
No? And it stands to reason that the Crónica becomes such a powerful genre in Mexico City because it's a great modern. It becomes a great modernist capital.
It becomes the great modernist capital. It's the great.
That's why Breton and Lawrence and everybody's going down there.
That's why they're all going there. Yeah, it's incredibly important. Yeah. But for me, it was just seemed obvious to call it a Crónica because it's not a memoir. Memoir is a funny word in Spanish.
Memoria.
And whether unfairly or not, the stigma is, like if you're Rigoberto Menchú and you're going to write like a super political tract, then it's memoir. If you're Julian Herbert to write about a recent masterpiece and you're going to write about being raised by your mother who was a prostitute, it's a novel, even though it's what here they would call memoir. It's a way of distancing yourself a little bit from saying this is primarily, I mean, you know, that's the perception. That's how the writers I know. The writers I know tend to associate the word memoir with something that has an overt political reason for being. Testimonial literature. Mm-hmm. What we call testimonial literature in Latin American, they call memoir.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Move forward. The book takes place across 2 years. We talked a little bit about 2012 and the country's moment and your moment fusing, right? Mm-hmm. 2013 is a very different year, and the last part of the book, which is kind of I felt was like a book unto itself, concentrates on a tragedy that occurred at a place called Heavens, in English.
Yeah,
the term heaven was used, an after-hours club where 12 young people from 13, a working class, yeah. I'm sorry, 13 people were from a working class neighborhood called Tepito, in broad daylight, were kidnapped, and it shook the city. And I happened to be there with my family, and it certainly shook my family. We have young twin daughters, and the Levantón, as it's called, the mass kidnapping, took place about 2 blocks away from my twin daughter's favorite restaurant in the Zona Rosa.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
You talk about Mexico City and certain parts of Mexico City is living in a bubble apart from the greater metropolitan area and indeed greater Mexico during this era of violence. But this case seemed to bring the violence home to the heart of the city, and an extraordinary something extraordinary happens to the conscience of the city, and it calls to you, and you take this on as a mission almost. Why? What called to you so powerfully, personally, to put you on this crusade, kind of like journalistic crusade?
Well, it's all in the first half of the book, setting you up for the second half, even though I was living it and didn't realize it. You know, I mean, like the first half of the book is, until I start doing my driving experiment, it's like the anti-travel book, right? I'm saying, this is about living in Mexico City, but you have to understand, the way I live now is I have this really nice apartment that I got lucky to have on this really nice little plaza. I go down the elevator in the morning. I go across the park. I have breakfast and write in this really nice cafe. I go back up to my apartment. I write all afternoon. I go to the gym. I go to the cantina. And that's it. And that's how I live in Mexico City. So what? Right? That's my way of living there. And it's a bubble world. I live in a bubble. And everybody, and I love my bubble. No? And everybody in Mexico City at this time, we're all very conscious. It's just this recurring phrase. Vivimos en una burbuja. Vivimos en una burbuja. We live in a bubble. How did Mexico City, which is in the 1990s, was synonymous with criminal chaos, right? People in the 1990s fled Mexico City for other parts of Mexico. It had the most corrupt police. It had the highest murder rate. It had the highest rate of kidnappings. It's everything in Mexico City changes in 1997, because before Mexico City, of course, the PRI would appoint who was governing the city. Right, finally in 97, they can elect their own mayors, and you get this turn, you get this quite extraordinary run of very powerful leftist, center-left or leftist mayors who really changed the city in really innovative ways, which we can talk about later. But so all of a sudden here now.
But just briefly, just a couple of progressive, like first one of the great world capitals to first legalize gay marriage.
Gay marriage. I think even more, that's very sexy, but I think even more important things. AMLO, who becomes, you know, the
Andrés
most powerful.
Manuel López Obrador.
Does extraordinary things to take the edge off obviously it's a poverty city, but he does incredible things to create a social safety net. You know, pensions to poor old people. So you won't see old people, you know, like make sure that like, you know, impoverished elderly people will at least have enough to live on, right? Extraordinary programs to keep kids, high school kids in school. You want to know why Mexico City is not full of assassin sicarios? That's one reason. No, it's like my girlfriend was working for a while, the one I have now, for Set Us All, the program. She would have to go around to the high schools and make sure that kids were going to classes in order to receive their monthly stipend to stay in school. You know, all kinds of programs like that. So too many to mention here. And then the visionary, Marcelo Ebrard, who decides, you know what? What is a great world capital? What makes a city a great world capital? Among other things, its public spaces shouldn't be just places that only the privileged can enjoy, right? You should create beautiful, fun spaces for everybody, right? And so it's just, wow, just so many initiatives, no? As well as building on the stuff AMLO had done in the safety net, right? So things like in the poor neighborhoods where kids have never even been to the ocean before. You know, trucking in tons of sand and building around the city, I think, 6 big public beaches inside the city, putting a huge skating rink in the Zocalo in the winter. And you think, oh, skating rink, so what? You see the lines, people waiting hours, you know. And I always think, you know, what does it mean to be a poor parent living in a vecindad, which is like the tenement buildings, you know, in those, you know, crowded, sometimes dangerous neighborhoods like Tepito. To be able to take your little kid by the hand and like teach them the ice, you know, give them this thing of ice skating. These are the things that make a city less brutal. You know, the bicycle sharing programs. My favorite was the dinosaur museum, you know, setting up this huge, getting all these donations and for like several months in the Zocalo, this enormous dinosaur museum. So everyone could take their kids to see dinosaurs. You know, those are the things that make a city.
Bicycling, closing down Paseo de la Reforma every Sunday.
All kinds of things like that. Mm-hmm. So the city, you know, and it's just all kinds of art. And the city at the same time is becoming very hip. You know, people come want to start to come. You know, the city begins to feel, especially the Condesa Roma bubble that we know so well, starts to become connected to like the
just like Silver Lake Echo Park would be the,
you know, starts
the
to
corollaries.
It's part of the new, you know, interconnected global world of hipness, you know? And at the same time...
And just for a quick geography lesson, Roma Condesa, sort of like Echo Park, the Levantón we're talking about, the Heavens case, takes place right across major boulevard, across, let's say, Sunset Boulevard. Right there.
And there's one right, Rosa, right, which is basically part of it. It's already... Yeah. Juarez is now becoming gentrified, too. Mm-hmm. And so the big thing, we're all aware this horrible tragedy is happening all over the country, obviously. I mean, I'm good friends with a lot of journalists. You know, it's not like we're oblivious, right? Mexico, 2/3 of Mexico is living a terrible, and has been for 10 years, just an unspeakable tragedy, right? Which is the havoc and violence wreaked on ordinary citizens by organized crime and complicit government, right? Because the government is in no way not like this with it, right? Especially the local governors, the state governments, and so forth. And me and my own preoccupations, you know, I'm a little obsessed with it even when it's far away from me. You know, I can't get this idea out of my head that, out as death, you know, it was a very sudden, violent death out as. And I struggled with very real trauma symptoms for years. And I kept just thinking all the time, you know, this city, this country is like a, it's like a giant lunatic asylum where no one's getting any treatment. You know,
a national trauma,
thousands of people who've lost their loved ones.
So many of them without bodies to
so many without bodies to find, sometimes bodies hacked to bits, sometimes just gotten down. And I just, you know, was like, so I was thinking about it, right? And you know, and it's very dangerous for journalists. Even the bravest, best journalists will tell you that you can't really go up to the narco zones and report. No, it's, you know, they hunt down bloggers. You know, in places like Tamaulipas, if somebody, like, anonymous blogger says, the narcos just kidnapped and killed these people in my neighborhood, if they can, they'll find out who you are and kill you for having written that. Newspapers in a lot of those cities have the cartels put people in the newspapers, in the offices themselves, to say, let me see the copy, we decide what gets published. Right? And if you defy it, you are dead. And you know, Mexico City State, where Peña Nieto, the president of Mexico, is from, while the great savior of Mexico was governor of Mexico City State, femicides. You always know cartels are strong in a place when they start killing women, because that's their sport. Right? And femicides never go up in a place unless the cartels are strong. And where the cartels are strong, it means the government is complicit because they can't do it otherwise, really. I mean, it's clear, right? It's obvious. No one in Mexico thinks otherwise. And while Peña Nieto's governor of Mexico, femicides go up 106% in Mexico City State. No, and Mexico State is right on the border of the DF. So you're constantly feeling it coming closer and closer and closer. Right? And so in the summer of 2012, you know, something happened in my life in February to precipitate me out of the blue to decide to write this. I had no idea I was going to write this. And I end up writing, you know, I feel like I've come, you know, I'm celebrating the city. I'm writing about my own emergence from the particular cave I was in. And there's a bit of innocence to it. There's a bit of romance to it. It doesn't mean it's not true, right? And I finished the book. I finished the first part, and it's like June of 2013. No, May of 2013. And I look around, and I go, everything's changing. No, and May 26th, the Levantón happens. Just blocks from where I live. Like literally, I don't know, quarter of a mile from where I live. Mm-hmm. No, and I realized that, well, you know, right now this is an incomplete story. I have to tell the story of 2013 too. And the difference of the two parts is the themes carry through, right? And you know, a through theme is, I mean, it's for all the fun stuff in the first part and even some of the, you know, it's a kind of spiritual journey too. I'm really driven to get close to this. And
by the way, I saw you in June, mid-June maybe, last year, right outside your apartment. He lives in Plaza Rio de Janeiro, beautiful place, really that you described earlier. And once again, the Silver Lake Echo Park, you know, Bohemian district. And you were rushing, and I said, Frank, hey, you want to grab coffee? But he was literally a man on a mission. You know, that's what it felt like. It was, there was this urgency. I was struck by how driven you were. I have a meeting with the families of the Heavens case, and I got to go meet them right now. And it was like 10 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. And as I've thought about it, you know, when I mentioned my family's little connection, you know, that this, like you, it happened just a couple of blocks away. Just the sense that as cronistas, we have a responsibility here, right? This is what the crónica is about. This is what it's for. And I'm also very conscious of time because Kronos, that's where Kronika comes from, right? It's time itself. It's 2012. Oh, but wait, 2013 is here. I got to keep on writing. The Kronika doesn't end, right? The writer's always trying to catch up to history. But this moment is a really critical one, a crossroads for the country. And
certainly for the city.
Yes, yes. And we only have a couple of minutes here, but I don't want to leave it on this dark note, because ultimately, it's not the city of death that this book is about. And you're seeking the city of life.
It's all about the city of life, and that's why when you see the dark, you know, the kinds of forces that could turn it into the city of death emerge for the first time, it's an emergency. And you feel you have to, I felt I had to respond in the way I did. I don't think Mexico City is the city of death at all. I think what was going on there in that case certainly took away my innocence about how the city works. You know, I have I think I know what was going on in that case. But Mexico City, you know, I'm back again this summer, right? There hasn't been another Heaven's case since then. The city is not in the exuberant, full flower, golden age that I think in history people will see the AMLO-Ebrard 12-year back-to-back city governments. I think people will see those as representing a kind of golden age. I think it's not going to be so easy ever again, as long as the PRI is in power. But I really see the Mexico City personality kind of refusing to buckle. No, and because Mexico City, to be itself, has to stand in existential opposition to what the PRI represents. Has to. Right? And if it stops, it's really not Mexico City anymore. It's Toluca.
And Frank Goldman, as a writer, stands in existential opposition ultimately to that city of death, which is the city of corruption and impunity, which represents the PRI. And I thank you for this chronicle, which fuses the your personal grief, connecting it to the larger circle of grief that the country is in. And it's a salve on the wound. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, man.
We want to have a dialogue with you all, with Chilangos and natives and people who visited just once and who fell in love or fell out of love.
Hi, thank you very much, both of you. I lived in Mexico City in 1972. I was an American saxophone player at the Señor Real in Zona Rosa. I lived in Ansures, in Rio Lerma. I lived in Roma, in La Cerrada de Salamanca. I miss it so deeply. I haven't been there since 1983. I'm scared. But I want to go back. I want you to tell me, it might be a little dangerous, but so is all of life, but don't worry about it.
It's not dangerous.
Great.
No, yeah,
that's
it's
all
not
I wanted.
Dangerous. You're not going to go, there's certain neighborhoods you're not going to go walk around in at by yourself, you know, at 10 at night, or maybe certain neighborhoods any hour. But on the whole, I think it's really important to stress it is not dangerous. It was dangerous in the 90s. You know, in the 1990s, everybody was getting kidnapped in taxis, right? I think the 1990s was the nadir.
Sequestro Express.
The Sequestro Express says that.
Express kidnapping.
I hail taxis all the time, though. You know, I mean, the city is not, I can't stress enough, the city is not that dangerous, chaotic place it used to be.
I appreciate that. I just have to tell you this one little anecdote. Yeah. Leaving the club at 3 in the morning with my saxophone under my arm, recognizable, walking to Rio Lerma at 3 in the morning without anybody giving me a look. I never thought about it.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm kind of comparing it to. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, it'll never be quite that again, but.
No, it's <sir, no.
laughs> Hi, my name is Victor. And, you know, I just want to quickly say to the gentleman that just made that comment, I went to Mexico City last year by myself for 2 weeks. It was my first time. My parents are from Mexico. And completely felt safe, and yeah. And I did not have any problems. But I want to ask you this question because, I mean, you tell us about these the age when you were there, right? And you said you're early in 20s or 30s. And what kind of advice or what message would you tell the newer generations that are afraid to go back to Mexico City or to explore it and to find the beauty? Because when I went and I fell in love with it, and I want to keep going back, but my friends are also under the same stigma that it's this dangerous city, and I'm just like, no, the art there, the food, the people, it's all poetry. And I mean, some of the residents there, when even the taxi cab driver who told me, I said, oh, naciste aquí, were you born here? And he said, sí, nací aquí, me eché a perder aquí. So I was born and I, you know, I waste my life here. But the residents there, have this stigma too. They create it. But so I wonder, like, what kind of message? What would you tell the younger generation now to go back and be have this spirit of discovery for Mexico City again?
Yeah, I'm really always surprised. The idea of like timid young people really confuses me. You know? It's like. We were never that way. I was never, and I can't believe, I didn't even know that. I think, oh, everyone wants to come to Mexico City. It's there's nothing to, that's not, I never for 1 minute in my book do I ever give the impression that Mexico City has become unsafe for the young traveler, right? Tell them, to listen to see some movies and listen to the music, listen to One Sit It All, listen to Cafe Tacuba, get into the spirit, it's a crazier city, right? I mean, when I see how people live in New York City, young people live in New York City, I think young people now live in New York City the way people live in Zurich, Switzerland or something. No? And so the bit of like the edginess, Mexico City's undoubtedly, undoubtedly a crazier. It's a handful, Mexico City, an handful. It's not like you can. It's not dangerous in the way that should keep anyone from going there. But it's exhausting, right? It you have to be on your toes. There's things going on all the time. I think it's the part of the fabulousness of it. No, it's great in the it's great and mysterious, and the way great cities are in like 19th century novels and Balzac or something, right? It's all kinds of characters, all kinds of schemers, all kinds of hustlers. It's just so full of human creativity, you can't believe it. No, and I just love that. It's pure adrenaline. But it has pretty much the same murder rate as New York City. That's really important to realize. That hasn't changed, even with the stresses we had last year, right? The terrible things that went on last year, by the way, weren't necessarily threatening to people like us living there. There was something deep down, it was a change in criminal structures going on. Essentially, you began to see, like somebody says, and it's very important to understand when somebody, a very important source says, this city works in ways that nobody wants to see broken, right? It's a complicated city. It takes a Balzac to really dramatize it. There are alliances between organized crime, police, politics, the business sector, that a good mayor, for example, like Ebrard and Lopez Obrador, know how to keep all in balance. When that thing breaks, right, as it broke last summer in the Heavens case, it was really about one political group, one political party, wanting the rest control of that equilibrium, one political party allied with a narcotics cartel, from the people who had been there before. And I think that's what the Heaven's Case was finally really about. And it's dangerous to the city because it represents an overall strategy, I think, for the PRI to get control of the city. Because if you control police corruption, if you control the street trade and drugs, you're controlling upwardly spiraling chains of corruption. But it doesn't necessarily change the safety of the city, right? That's something else, right? So you're talking about like deep, crazy secret structures that are about the way the city really works, which I think we just got to peek at in that case. That case exposed things, that I think since then have been covered up again, right? We're never going to hear the whole story. We're never going to hear the whole story.
And it also exposed the bubble itself, right?
Exposed the bubble, yeah. No one thinks it's the bubble anymore. That's the great thing. In a way, it's a good thing. You know, like I say, to me, this story is also about a loss of innocence, my own loss of innocence. I stopped thinking, oh, what a romantic, sweet city, lefty paradise, progressive, wow. You know, it's like, it's a real tough place. But thank God it works in the ways it needs to work to keep citizens on the street safe. I think it does. You know, it's in all the, just the way pressures are exerted, like the business sector is very important. The business sector has to work with the lefty political center. It's in nobody's interest for the city to become chaotic. You know, so it's just fascinating. It's just fascinating. That's all I can say. You know, my girlfriend who grew up in places like Iztapalapa, which are really, considered dangerous working class slums. We spent the last 10 months in New York City. And she was taking language classes. And I live in a pretty cool part of Brooklyn. That's a bubble too, right? And she, because of the friends she was making in her language classes, other Mexican women and stuff like that, she was constantly going to hang out with them in like South Bronx and places like that. And she would come, she like in 10 months got to know the city better than I knew it. She'd come back and say, I got to tell you something. The Bronx is scarier than any part of Iztapalapa I've ever seen.
Where are we at?
Hi. The mattress that you were talking about before?
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to leave any sperm on it?
Well, we put a, we had to go buy a, those things you use for bedwetters? Like a little plastic kind of shroud to put over it? Because she wouldn't let us throw it out. Adele was her name. So on the plastic sheet, I guess. It's a cultural center now. Not the bed. the building.
Okay.
Hi, thank you. My name is Fabiola, and I was born and raised in Mexico City. And just before coming to Los Angeles, I used to live in Plaza Rio de Janeiro. And now I live in Silver Lake. So
there you go.
Talk about bubbles. However, I was reflecting on what you said about AMLO and the setting the support network for all peoples. And the allowance that provides to older folks in Mexico City, it's not only for low-income class, but also like for my dad, who is wealthy. And he actually wanted to go and return the allowance, and they said, no, you cannot return it. It's for everyone. So reflecting on it with my friend Eileen, she says that we're talking about dignity.
Yeah.
Giving back dignity to the people of Mexico City, and even through maybe same-sex marriage. And also, the
abortion.
Vanguard abortion, exactly, termination of pregnancies. And speaking of, I was...
Mammograms, free mammograms
exactly.
For all the women in the city.
And about this bubble, it's also the people in the bubble who have been changing. And I was part of it, one of the parties that presented these proposals, legislations. I was working at the party, at the Social Democratic Party. So it's also, you know, it's very complicated, but you still find people that want to fight for social justice. And speaking of this, like from the commodity of everything, like all privileges. And I think that's what also part of what keeps the city progressing. And then support from the people that have been able to have dignity. And and also thank you for bringing that light into your book, because you're allowing us to see how these classes mix and keep providing this type of progress to a wonderful city that I miss every day.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. That's exactly right. No, it's, you know, I laugh sometimes when I see people like saying, oh, government never works, and, you know, deriding the concept of government or deriding, you know, the kind of values you're talking about. And that's a big part of what makes Mexico City so proud. I mean, that's the big transformation these last series of city governments in collusion with, in collaboration with the citizens did. They took a city that people were ashamed to be from before, was a stigma to be from Mexico City, and people are proud. You know, they know it's an adventure to live there. They know it can be very trying, right? Everyone talks about héroes chilangos. You're an héroe just to live there in some ways, right? But there's a real pride, right, in what they've managed to do with that city. It's under attack because of the things I mentioned, but I really believe the citizens also will just not, you know, I don't think they'll be so easily tricked. No, it's, I think it's so important, you know, what you say. And I think another important part, too, when I was talking to Marcelo Ebrard, the mayor, I had a series of conversations with him, and I thought he just said something, too, really. I think that, you know, why is Mexico City so different from the rest of the country in so many ways? And they have a long way to go, as he was the first to admit, in terms of providing educational opportunities for everybody, especially in public university education. It's a scandal that so few people can go to the UNAM. The UNAM takes so many people, but if you don't get into the UNAM or the UAM, you know, it's very difficult. But still, despite that, they're so, compared to anywhere else in the country, I think in the rest of Mexico, and obviously Mexico, you know, education, government after federal government after federal government has left education just so, it's an ignored sector of the country, right? And Mexico City has, the DF has really put a huge emphasis on that all, you know, through these years. And so he told me something like students between 18 and 22, you know, the university ages, in Mexico City, something like 60-something percent of them are in education programs, some kind of college-level studying. Whereas in the rest of the country, the level's like 18%. He says, right there, that tells you why this country is so different. Right? Why it makes people more tolerant, it makes people less violent, obviously, it makes gives people much more, you know, different kinds of values and so forth. It's you know, I think when you talk about, you know, you shouldn't, and you're really right to point this out, you shouldn't, I don't want to give the impression that it was these strong mayors that changed the city. I think the mayors are an expression of what the population of the city wanted. And this is born in the aftermath of the 1985 earthquake. That's really the moment that changes everything. Because when that earthquake hits and schools collapse and, you know, thousands and thousands of small children are crushed to death because those school buildings were built on pre-corruption, where all the building codes were ignored because pre-politicians were on the take and pre, you know, bureaucrats and so forth, right? It created, you know, and there was no, everyone still talks about how in the aftermath of that airport, of that earthquake, there was no government help, right? It was the citizens of Mexico City that dug that city out of that earthquake. And I even remember, I don't know if you remember, all around the world, there was astonishment and just this worldwide sense of just being so impressed with how that community came alive and came together and to bring that, put that city back on its feet. And that's when the PRI was finished. That was the end of the PRI in Mexico City.
No. And so much came out of that politically and culturally as well, right? Yeah. I remember people of my generation becoming the wave of Mexican rock.
Mexican rock is born
Café
in that.
Tacuba.
Gay culture is born in that. Yes. There's a new book out all about that, Guillermo Sorno's book.
The City of Life emerging from the city
from the ashes.
Of death.
Absolutely, yeah.
Final question.
I'm a Chilanga. I was born in Mexico. I'm very proud of Mexico. Mexico has a lot of history. I encourage everyone to go. We have a home there. We go at least 4 or 5 times a year. We walk on the streets. We go to the cafes. We visit the museum. Unfortunately, nothing has happened to us. So
yeah.
I think all big cities have areas you have to avoid, not just Mexico City.
Yeah, so it could
please,
be more.
Please go and visit. It's great.
Que viva Chilangolandia. Francisco Goldman, Frank Goldman, thank you once again.
Thank you, all of you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.